and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with President Trump's executive order that he held up to the press today with a self-satisfied smile, which the Democratic leader in the Senate says is aimed at sabotaging the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. Sarah Leak, a senior policy analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, who works on healthcare reform implementation, health insurance exchanges, and private market reform included in the Affordable Care Act, joins us to discuss her article at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Trump order could destabilize health insurance markets, hurt those with pre-existing conditions, and the likely impact of Trump's executive order combined with efforts within HHS by its former head Tom Price to sabotage the ACA via administrative obstacles. We will analyze the extent to which the insurance pool essential to the ACA's economic viability will be rendered ineffective as younger, healthier participants are encouraged to pay less for less coverage, ensuring that there'll be less money in the pool to take care of older, sicker patients and those with pre-existing conditions. Then we will speak with Robert J. Lifton, an award-winning psychiatrist, historian, and public intellectual, about his article at the New York Times, Our Changing Climate Mindset, and his new book, just out, The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival. We will discuss how climate change is turning weather events from disasters into catastrophes, forcing us to change our collective consciousness to look upon ourselves as members of a single species in deep trouble aboard lifeboat Earth. Then finally, we'll examine the Republican tax plan with Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who has an article at the Huffington Post, The Republican Plan to Slow Growth. We will discuss how allowing pass-through businesses to pay less in taxes has crippled revenues and almost bankrupted the state of Kansas and will surely explode the deficit if adopted at a national level, and how the plan to eliminate the federal tax deduction for state and local taxes is aimed at punishing successful states like California, who largely vote for Democrats. And joining us now is Sarah Leak, who is the senior policy analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, where she works on issues related to health reform implementation, specifically health insurance exchanges and private market reforms included in the Affordable Care Act. She's also a consumer representative to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners and has an article at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Trump Order Could Destabilize Health Insurance Markets, Hurt Those with Pre-Existing Conditions. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Leak.
Thank you very much.
And already Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, has issued a statement following the signing of the executive order today by President Trump, and he held it up to the press cameras with a huge smile on his face, a very self-satisfied smile, but that's very much in contrast to the criticism coming from Senator Schumer saying, quote, having failed to repeal the law in Congress, the president is sabotaging the system, using a wrecking ball to single-handedly rip apart our health care system. If the system deteriorates, make no mistake about it, the blame will fall squarely on the president's back. So do you think that will be the outcome, or will the president be able to say, well, it's failing and he'll just accelerate the fact that he's been making a case that's been failing? But Tom Price, who was just fired as the head of HHS, he was also sabotaging the ACA as much as he could from the inside through administrative tricks. So who's going to end up? I mean, well, let's start with this question. What do you think is the fate of the ACA? Is it going to survive this?
Well, I mean, President Trump has made it clear from day one that he was going to try to blow up health insurance markets and the ACA, and hopefully that won't occur, but the policies that are being pushed under this executive order and the larger efforts to sabotage the ACA, for example, by not marketing and doing as much outreach to consumers who need to buy health insurance or on their own, that's already having an impact on insurers, on the premiums that people are going to have to pay, and could well have an impact on enrollment going forward. So the specific outcome of the policies that were put forward in the executive order today remains to be seen, but certainly this administration is trying to attack the law in as many ways as it can.
Well, it would seem, though, that Tom Price, of course, he got fired for use of expensive private jets. But it seemed like when he was at the head of HHS, his job was to do as much as he could to sabotage it from the inside, because he cut the ACA sign-up period for insurance by half. He shut down the maintenance for the website people used to sign in for health insurance. And he slashed fundings for outreach and repeatedly threatened to end subsidies to insurance companies who cover the poor, and which, of course, you know, insurance companies operate on certainty and stability. So there's already been an effort underway, has there not, before this executive order was signed today, to destabilize insurance markets?
There has been, and I actually don't think that just because Secretary Price isn't secretary anymore that that means that this is going to stop, obviously. It's a broader threat to the law than just one person. It's the entire, you know, posture of this administration. The rates, the premium rates that insurers have proposed for coverage that will be available in 2018 in the individual insurance market, they're already proposing rates that are higher than they would have otherwise been because of administration sabotage. So, you know, from the everything from the CSR payments, the payments for people with lower incomes to help them meet their deductibles, the fate of those payments to insurers not being clear, that has led to increased rates, and that is directly a result of some of the comments that Trump has made about those payments. There's been signals to the insurers that the individual mandate that requires people either buy coverage or pay a penalty, that may not be as well enforced, even though it's still there and the law hasn't been repealed and the mandate hasn't been repealed. The coverage is there and the subsidies are available to the people that are eligible for them. The rates that unsubsidized people will pay in 2018 are higher than they would have already otherwise been already because of sabotage. So we're really just seeing things now just get worse than they would have otherwise been. But I don't think there's any doubt about why that is.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Leek, who is a senior policy analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, where she works on issues related to health reform implementation, specifically health insurance exchanges and private market reforms included in the Affordable Care Act. She's also a consumer representative to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners and has an article at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, "Trump Order Could Destabilize Health Insurance Markets, Hurt Those with Pre-Existing Conditions." My understanding, though, is that, you know, the order primarily affects small businesses and people who buy the private coverage on their own rather than through employers. And that has been the area that the ACA was focusing on, trying to encourage single young workers into the pool. And, of course, their work cut out because young people often see themselves as being somewhat invincible. And why should I pay for something that I'm not going to use? And the whole point of an insurance pool is that you've got to broaden the pool as much as possible to have the younger, healthier people pay in to offset the cost for older, sicker people. And the bigger the pool, the more secure and solid the insurance market is. So by, in effect, showing the young people the door, saying, you know, you don't have to pay for expensive plans, we're offering up these cheap ones that will cost you a lot less, and it won't give you as much coverage, but, you know, it's almost an enticement, isn't it, for them to leave the pool.
I mean, I think, you know, your point is well taken, that when the major improvements that were made under the ACA, apart from the Medicaid expansion, were improvements in the individual insurance market where people buy coverage on their own, usually because they don't have coverage from an employer. There were major, you know, improvements in affordability and accessibility, especially for people with pre-existing conditions in those markets. They couldn't get coverage before, they had to pay too much, or the coverage wasn't good. So those things have improved so much, and I think the path that the executive order takes us on, particularly as it pertains to allowing an expansion of short-term plans, which don't have to meet all the standards for that the ECA plans have to meet. These short-term plans, if they are expanded, if they're allowed to last for long periods of time, could become an alternative to ACA coverage, more comprehensive ACA coverage for many people. They may be lured in by a cheaper premium, but then find out that, you know, that plan doesn't cover certain benefits. It has high cost sharing. And its premium depends on the health status of the individual. So it's really something that's going to pull healthy people out. And even those healthy people, if they don't turn out to be as healthy, may find that these plans are leaving them in the lurch if they do have health needs. So it's a concern both at the market level, where we want healthy and sick people to all be in the same market, so we're all spreading the costs around among each other, but also for the individual consumers who might think that they're going to be healthy that year, but then they turn out not to be and their plan isn't there for them any longer.
So where do the insurance companies themselves stand on this? Because one of the ways that the Obama administration got them in on the act, and as you recall, they were certainly aware of the history of Hillary Clinton's efforts during the early Clinton administration, where the insurance companies basically ran a very sophisticated TV ad campaign to kill the rather halting efforts on the part of the Clinton administration to have some kind of health care reform. That was, you know, it was killed before it even got off the ground. And I think the Obama people figured, well, we got to have them inside the tent to draw the insurance people inside these big powerful companies into the tent. They offered the idea that they would be able to subsidize people who normally couldn't afford insurance, and therefore you'd get a whole bunch more customers. Is that a thumbnail sketch of what happened?
Yeah, I mean, some insurance companies have definitely been, you know, going full speed ahead into this new market that was expanded and improved by the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, they've spent several years now adjusting to the new rules and trying to figure out how to make money, trying to get their products priced correctly. And if these were normal times, we would now, a few years in, be looking at a case of a much more stable market, a set of insurers offering coverage who are much more used to the rules and how to deal with consumers and what the plans are requiring them to, you know, the plans that they're requiring to offer. But instead, we're in this continued series of challenges and continued uncertainty when things really should be getting much better. So I guess what I would say about the insurer's response to the executive order is we don't, you know, fully know yet what everybody's going to think about it, but I think the insurers that want to offer ACA coverage recognize for the problems that it causes, that it could let other insurers pull away healthier people, that damages the market, that damages the insurers that remain in that market. If this kind of uncertainty and big policy changes from the administration continue going forward, which it seems like that's what the executive order is aimed at doing, then you could see insurers not wanting to offer coverage in the market, in the ACA compliant market. There are other insurers that want to offer short-term coverage or association health plans. And, you know, insurers may decide to adapt to those new types of alternative products and go back to the old way of doing business. And that would be really, really unfortunate. You know, we want to maintain an ACA market where insurers are competing on the price of the products that they offer, hopefully the quality of the benefits and the services that they're providing to people, and not based on whether they can attract more healthy people or reduce their exposure to sick people. That's the old way of doing business. And I would like to think we've moved past that. But if the rules change a lot, insurers will follow those rules and they'll compete on the old way of doing business and try to get rid of sick people or scale back benefits to avoid, you know, the people that are going to need those benefits.
But that seems to be what's going on here, isn't it? The idea that you offer enticements to the young who, you know, they had to be kind of dragged kicking and screaming into this in the first place, for the reasons we mentioned earlier, just to, you know, because they just think I'm healthy, I don't need this. So if they're going to start offering them up cheaper products that won't do that much for them, but that's all in the small print, and that's all in the future, etc., I can't see them going any other way. They're going to make more money with less risk because they'll have more young people, healthier people, and the products themselves won't cost them as much. So I don't imagine, I mean, that was the whole point, wasn't it? How do you find a way to sort of share the costs and particularly take care of people with pre-existing conditions when previously insurance companies were able to discriminate and basically choose their customers. It's almost the same way that the Supreme Court ruling on gerrymandering is going on, where the argument is, you know, politicians shouldn't choose their voters. Voters should choose their politicians.
Well, I mean, I think the California experience would show the opposite of the story that the president and other critics of the Affordable Care Act have been telling. They seem to want to tell a story of a market that is destined to fail, but in fact they think is already failing. In reality, the California experience shows just how well things can work, and actually that young and healthy people do enroll in coverage if you do a good job of investing in outreach and enrollment efforts to let people know what's there, if they're available, if there are subsidies available and good plans that are affordable available to them, letting them know that that's there, providing assistance and help to people to get them through the enrollment process and the eligibility process and to get to that point where they're actually enrolled in coverage, which, you know, it's a complicated thing and some people need help. So California has actually put a lot of dollars behind that and made a lot of effort to make that work. And they've had a good experience enrolling more people in the marketplace coverage there, more of a higher percentage of younger people than the federal exchange states did, because they made that a goal and they continue to try to foster that enrollment. And I guess what we'll have to see with what these agencies end up, the federal agencies end up doing in response to this directive that the president has given them, you know, right now nothing has really changed yet. Those crappy plans that we were just talking about, they exist, but they're not allowed to last for more than 3 months at a time yet. So they're not really long-term coverage options. They're still short-term plans, and the ACA enrollment period is less than 3 weeks away, and there's lots of people who are going to benefit from getting those ACA plans, getting subsidies. There may be new people who are thinking about whether to enroll, and I wouldn't want them to get the message that they shouldn't enroll. That coverage is still there for them. So we'll wait and see what the federal agencies do. It could take many months for that process to unfold. And in addition, states hopefully will have the ability and the authority to continue to do what they've done all along in our history in terms of regulating the individual insurance market and making sure that the consumers in their states are protected. So I don't think this is all said and done. I think we need to wait and see what ends up happening, how far the administration tries to push, and whether what they try to do is legal, whether what they try to do is something that that states will tolerate, or whether the states will act to prevent some of those things from happening, at least for their own residents. So I think the story isn't over. And the near term is that consumers need to, you know, if they're buying insurance on their own, if they don't have other access to coverage, they should be aware that enrollment is about to start and that they should go and check out what plans are available to them and what the premiums are, because they might be able to find a good deal. And for the near term, that's all any of us can really do.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute, it would seem, though, that given, 50-plus times that the Republicans in the House and Senate voted to repeal and replace Obamacare, then the attempts to do it that fell short, which obviously irritated President Trump a lot, since he'd staked his whole campaign in many ways on getting rid of this horrible thing that he called Obamacare. It feels as though this is all about the president satisfying his campaign promise and feeling good about finally he's found a way to do it. And it seems as though this is about our president's ego and the health of Americans is a very distant afterthought.
I mean, for me, it's about that, you know, since the ACA passed, we've hit a historic low in our uninsured rate in this country. And millions of people have benefited both from an expanded Medicaid program and from an expanded individual insurance market. And all of that is still there for them. So I guess for me, you know, we can only deal with the issue that's right immediately in front of us. So we'll wait and see what comes of the specific potential regulatory changes that would be devastating to people in the individual insurance market in many places around the country if they happen. But for right now, we know that there are still plans there. There's Medicaid coverage there for people who qualify for it. So in the short term, I hope that's what people will focus on. There's been some troubling survey data that shows that some people actually think the law was repealed. So that would be unfortunate if all of this noise around repeal, which actually the law hasn't been repealed, it would be unfortunate if the public missed out on coverage that's there for them right now and for 2018 because they mistakenly thought the law had been repealed or that the president's action today was immediately ripping coverage away from them. I think we're all very concerned about the impact of this regulatory process that's about to unfold. But for the moment, people should just stay calm and enroll in health insurance.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today, Sarah Leake.
Thank you.
And again, I'll be speaking with Sarah Leake, who's a senior policy analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, where she works on issues related to health reform implementation, specifically health insurance exchanges and private market reforms included in the Affordable Care Act. She's also a consumer representative to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and she has an article at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Trump Order Could Destabilize Health Insurance Markets, Hurt Those with Pre-Existing Conditions. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with Robert J. Lifton, an award-winning psychiatrist, historian, and public intellectual, about his new book, just out, The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival.
And so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we've got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure, but we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth. And those pills make me above.
At least it's not the end of the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert J. Lifton, an award-winning psychiatrist, historian, and public intellectual, has written more than 20 books, including Death in Life, Survivors of Hiroshima, and The Nazi Doctors, Medical Killings, and the Psychology of Genocide. He has an op-ed at the New York Times, Our Changing Climate Mindset, and his latest book just out is The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert J. Lifton.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, thank you for joining us. And I must say, today, looking at the headlines, I was very disturbed by the picture of President Trump holding up the executive order that he's just signed to eviscerate Obama's Affordable Care Act. And there was a smug, self-satisfied grin on his face where the document that he was holding up will absolutely ruin the lives of millions of his fellow Americans. And it's just capricious and unnecessarily cruel and based upon some, you know, psychotic problem he has with Obama himself, where he wants to undo things that Obama did. So it seems to me that the battle lines are pretty clear today, that we really, the battle lines are between empathy and selfishness.
Well, with Trump, I see him as being what I call solipsistic, meaning everything that he experiences or claims to know has to come through his self and what that self needs, rather than actual information with empathy for others or a plan over a longer period of time. And in that way, he can feel a need to undo whatever Obama accomplished. And of course, he's trying to do that with health care and certainly with climate change.
But nothing that's happened so far with either him or the Republican Congress has done anything to build up America, improve the lives of American citizens. It seems to be all about tearing things down and enriching the already very rich.
Yes, that's very true. But I take the point of view, both in my book and in that op-ed that you mentioned, that on something like climate change and global warming, there is developing a more accurate mindset, a mindset that recognizes, is aware of global warming as a universal problem and that we're contributing to and the need to do something about it. And you can register, you can recognize that change in mindset by looking at the studies that are done, attitudes of people. They've changed to that direction. And that's what I call the climate swerve. And my argument is that even Trump can't undo all of that. He's not able to be beyond that swerve or that gain in collective consciousness.
Well, it's obvious from anybody that's watching news and television that these disasters we've had in Texas, Florida, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands, we're used to disasters, but now they've turned into catastrophes. And you argued in the New York Times piece, Robert J. Lifton, that President Trump and Pruitt, the head of the EPA, are fighting a losing battle. That's some music to my ears, so elaborate, if you will.
Well, what I mean by that is that, first of all, it's impossible to be completely a climate denier these days. That's why I call them climate rejectors, because in some part of their minds, they have to have some inkling that climate change is a real problem, that it's human created, and that something needs to be done. But this idea is not acceptable to their sense of themselves, and particularly to their sense that government can never interact or interfere in these matters, which of course is very necessary if one is to do anything about climate change. So, and there's evidence that, and I know from lots of work I've done, that the mind can hold at the same time two antithetical views about the world, and that's what I think is going on. So that they're fighting a losing battle because certainly since Paris in 2015, there's been a general species-wide recognition of what global warming really is and of some of the ways that it has to be handled. And nobody's free of some of that recognition.
And again, go ahead.
The other thing I say in the piece is that Trump wanted to take us out of Paris, which is egregious in itself. It's really criminal in terms of the human future. But he's had difficulty doing that. And as soon as he announced that we were leaving Paris, you heard from governors all over the country saying that they would, their states would carry through the Paris pledges, and mayors said the same about their cities, and there were expressions from Europe and from China and from different parts of the world to the effect that the Paris Accord was irreversible. So that's an example of what I mean by a changing mindset toward climate. And that's what makes Pruitt and Trump fighting, puts them in the situation of fighting a losing battle in continuing to reject climate change. And with Trump, you know, after all these objections to his taking us out of Paris, he kind of equivocated. There were various so-called clarifications from the White House, but they made things more vague and said that, well, we would go to climate meetings and maybe we can renegotiate. So he left the situation pretty much uncertain. It's not so easy to leave Paris because of the power of that swerve, of that recognition of climate change.
Well, maybe he's trying to have it both ways, to satisfy the Koch brothers on the one hand and they've been given the entire power of the US government and the Congress and gotten their entire wish list so far, or he's throwing a bone to his daughter who's allegedly concerned about global warming. And in your op-ed in the New York Times, you mention, and I must say, when you see the aerial pictures of Puerto Rico, it very much is, as you say, it's a bit like the aftermath of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. These hurricanes have, quoting you, have conveyed a similar feeling of world ending, having left whole islands, once alive in their beauty and commerce, in ruin. And there is, of course, a great deal of disquiet when you talk about nuclear weapons, and of course it's something that you've been concerned with for a long time. The good news is that the Cold War did end, and that the idea that we're all living for decades on a 30-minute lifeline where the world could end in 30 minutes and mutually assured destruction promised us that if we die, they die. And there was a great deal of gloom, but it did end. So that's, I guess, where I get some optimism from, is that this current threat to our existence on this planet could change, but what do you think will bring about the change? I take it that's really what your book's about, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. You know well that any activism is, with activism, there's no possibility of reaching a moment of satori where everything is achieved. It's a constant struggle. It never ends. And yes, there are the Koch brothers, and there are various corporate interests. They themselves are caught in this contradiction. So the only way we can see to survival without really ending our civilization is to take steps to reduce carbon emissions and to make our economy and world economies more and more involved with renewable energies. That's not impossible because the renewable energies have turned out to be much cheaper and a greater bargain economically, and there are lots of economic voices, leading spokespeople who are not shy about earning money, who make the point that the carbon economy doesn't have too much of an economic, doesn't have too much of a future. So that I speak of in this work and in earlier work, experience, economics and ethics, and the experience of now these hurricanes gives us imagery that's like nuclear imagery for the first time, I would say, in relation to climate. And that can contribute to this shift in mindset or this swerve that I'm talking about in relation to climate. But it has to be a process that combines a movement from below, from ordinary people like ourselves, on the one hand, and reasonably wise heads higher up in government, which we did see in relation to Paris in 2015. And I take hope from Paris because it does really express this kind of shift in mindset that I'm talking about.
Well, in your book, you mentioned the kind of utopian world at Los Alamos during World War II, all these brilliant minds up on the mesa. I worked at Los Alamos for a number of years. And the idea that in that utopian little commune, if you will, what came out of it was this horrendous weapon that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And
one of the great ironies.
Of the great ironies. But of course, when the bombs themselves, for all the destruction they did, if there was ever a silver lining, it was that they created something which we call the nuclear threshold. And we have not had a nuclear weapon used in anger since Nagasaki. And that is a line that nobody's crossed, even though they've contemplated on a few times. My fear about the person that we have in the White House now, and you have contributed to this new book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, you along with 26 other psychiatrists and mental health professionals, is that Trump could cross that nuclear threshold, and that we do not have. There is simply no impediment between him and the nuclear button. So if he wakes up on the wrong side of the bed, he could indeed end the world. And my understanding is that the adults around him, the generals, have basically, all they can do is kind of tackle him on the way to starting World War III. What an insane situation we're in. Don't you think that's something, in terms of the activism that you're invoking here, in terms of global warming and dealing with it, don't you think that should be our political priority to basically take this man's finger away from the nuclear button?
Absolutely. We should do everything we can to take his finger away from the nuclear button and to put barriers or constraints along the way to have more of a many-step process before anybody can set out, can create a nuclear war. It's a little bit of Dr. Strangelove in his possession. But I would emphasize what you said and what I say in my work, namely that the nuclear swerve, which we saw in the late 70s and in the 80s, which was a rejection of nuclearism, of dependence on the weapons to keep us going, a rejection of that and a rejection of claims of deterrence, which always involved the possibility of use, that movement probably contributed to the fact that the weapons haven't been used since Nagasaki in 1945. Of course, Trump is a very dangerous president, and that's why this movement, Duty to Warn, evolved from psychological professionals, and I'm part of it. We have to do everything we possibly can to constrain him, and people from this movement are exchanging ideas with senators and representatives, trying to bring that psychological insight into a political situation. Because if Trump is to be removed from office, which I hope will be the case before the end of his term, it's got to be a political process, I think. But this psychological recognition of his instability and danger can contribute to the political process.
And again, your new book, The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival, Robert J. Lifton, in the op-ed in the New York Times, you say that, just to describe what you mean by the climate swerve, you say the swerve is a change in collective consciousness that includes a coherent narrative of global warming, of cause and effect, and of steps necessary for mitigation. The swerve forces us to look upon ourselves as members of a single species in deep trouble. So, since we are all in Lifeboat Earth together, should we therefore think in terms of global patriotism instead of national patriotism?
Yes, absolutely. I say that that's exactly right. I say that the operative group is now the human species. It's no longer just family or nation or any ethnic kind of group. It's the whole species, because we're in it together. And if climate change, if either nuclear holocaust occurs or climate change reaches its extreme apocalyptic possibilities, it's all of us who are involved. So I have this toast in my book that we used to make at the doctors' anti-nuclear movement, in which either a Russian or an American doctor would make a very dramatic, pseudo-dramatic, melodramatic toast saying, "I toast you and your people and your leaders, because if you survive, we survive. If you die, we die." It's the same with climate, and people are realizing that, even if they don't put it in those words.
So how do we navigate to get to these goals in stopping climate change, or stopping the process towards more climate change, and dealing with mitigation if we can't, if that's what we have to? And then, and also, as I mentioned earlier, we successfully ended the Cold War, at least Gorbachev and Reagan to some extent led us into that extraordinary change. And that was a very hopeful example. But one thing that terrifies me about our country is that there's no consensus about what is real and what is true, and that you have Trump has got about 35% of the country believing that what Fox and Breitbart and Rush Limbaugh and people say is the truth, and the rest of it is fake news. And I don't know how we can get to the point where we can deal with a lot of the problems facing us if we not just have denial or rejection, as you call it, but simply no consensus about what's real and what's true.
Yes, well, that's a deep problem. I absolutely agree, because if someone creates his own reality and then tries to impose it on the country, democracy can't function. Democracy depends upon some sense of reality or actuality, some consensus about what occurs, and a response to evidence. And this is the reverse, really. But having said that, it means that we keep at it, and it means that we have both a movement outside of the electoral process and within it. We have to be more careful about who we vote for, and at the same time, we have to have a movement and extend our movement beyond the electoral process from below. And we have to do both. In that sense, we have to do everything. There's no simple solution.
Well, you've given us our marching orders, and I thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert J. Lifton.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Rob J. Lifton, who's an award-winning psychiatrist, historian, and public intellectual, who's written more than 20 books, including Death in Life, Survivors of Hiroshima, and The Nazi Doctors, Medical Killing and the Psychology of Genocide. He has an op-ed at the New York Times, Our Changing Climate Mindset. And his latest book just out is The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining the Republican tax plan.
The Patient Millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and is the author most recently of Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Republican Tax Plan to Slow Growth. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Well, thanks, Dean. And it seems to me that this Republican tax plan is, in fact, written to satisfy the donor class, but they have to sell it to their voters, both in particular Republican voters and even Democratic voters, for that matter. How are they going to navigate that? Because it is so flagrantly clear that this is really the wish list of the donor class that's going to shaft the very voters who voted for these congresspeople, senators, and Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, it's really quite striking that way. So you have a lot of things in here that are clearly going to reduce the taxes on the wealthy, particularly the very wealthy. So you're like getting rid of the estate tax. Almost no one pays that. It's like 0.2% of estates. You have to have, for a couple, they'd have to have an estate of more than $10 million. So you aren't just talking about, you know, successful business person or doctor or something. You're talking about someone who made a lot of money or inherited a lot of money to be subject to that tax at all. Gets rid of the alternative minimum tax, again, something that only pretty well-to-do people are ever going to see. And it lowers the top tax bracket, 39.6% to 35%. So those are all big deals, money going to the wealthy. And it reduces the corporate income tax rate from 35% to 20%. So these are all reductions in taxes for high-end earners. And what's striking here, we could go back to the last two times Republicans had big tax cuts under Ronald Reagan and then under George W. Bush. Both those times, obviously, were reducing taxes for the wealthy, but they also had tax cuts for middle-income people. So you can go to a truck driver, the group that Donald Trump was addressing the other day, you can go to more middle-income person go, look, you're getting $500, you're getting $1,000. So there was something there. It might not be much compared to what the very rich were getting, but you at least say, here's $500, here's $1,000. It was something. This tax plan, at least what we've seen today, and I'll be, I don't know whether it's fair or critical, it's not complete. We don't know it. You know, they say, oh, we haven't filled this in, we haven't filled that in, which is, again, another question, why didn't they? But what we've seen to date, it's not clear there's any tax cut for the vast majority of middle-income people, people earning $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year. We really don't know they're going to get anything. So their only way to sell it to them is by coming up with this story that there's going to be some big boost to growth and that, you know, come 2, 3, 5 years out, we're all going to be getting much higher pay because the economy is going to be so much bigger. So they're really, to try to make this at all plausible for typical working people, including a lot of voters for Donald Trump, you have to sell the growth story.
But the growth story is as fraudulent as everything else, isn't it? Haven't we been there before?
Yeah, and it really is kind of painful because it's kind of, one, there's a lot of research on this, and I understand people don't read economic research, but there is a lot of economic research on it, and I'm not going to say all, but most of it shows that the impact of reducing taxes on growth is at best minimal. I mean, the idea that people are going to work harder, that we're going to see an investment boom, there's very little research that supports that, but perhaps more importantly, we've done this experiment. So usually, you know, as economists, we're sitting there, okay, you know, how do we test for this? How do we test for that? In this case, we actually ran the grand experiment. We did it under Reagan. We did it under George W. Bush. No evidence. The growth was okay under Reagan, not particularly strong. It was actually weaker than the 70s. And under George W. Bush, the growth was very weak. And, of course, we ended up with the Great Recession. I'm not saying that was because of his tax cuts, but, you know, we did not end up with a good story following the Bush tax cuts. So been there, done that, didn't work. So how do you sell it? Well, one of the points, and this is what my starting point in that Huffington Post piece, was there is an argument, and there's some truth to this. I give Reagan a little bit of credit. There's an argument to having a simplified tax code, not getting rid of tax brackets. We could have 1,000 tax brackets. It's absolutely irrelevant. I mean, all of us, I assume everyone does their taxes the way I do. At the end of it, you go, your income was whatever number and tells you you owe $2,000 or $5,000. That's it. It doesn't, and you don't have to know whether that's based on there being one bracket or 100 brackets. It really doesn't matter. What you care about is that there aren't a whole lot of moving parts that allow people to play games with the tax code, and that's something that Reagan explicitly talked about, and he's absolutely right. We don't want people figuring out how they could say, oh, if I can make my income look like X when it's actually Y, then I could save a lot of money on my taxes. And that actually made a lot of sense, and they actually did that a little bit with their 86 tax reform. But this goes the other way. So he creates this special category of income, pass-through business income, for people to who have a pass-through business. I'll explain that in a second, to say they got their income from that, and then they'd only pay a 25% tax rate. So the idea here is someone could set up a business. Now, a lot of these businesses already exist, and that's fine. A lot of pass-through businesses tend to be smaller businesses. Someone has a corner grocery store or something. Those typically be a pass-through business. It means the business doesn't pay taxes. It goes back to the owner, and they pay taxes on it just as they would their wage income. So that's, as it stands now, that's fine, whatever, that wouldn't change. But for high-end earners, people would otherwise be paying the top bracket. They could instead arrange to get their money as a pass-through business, and instead of paying, at least under the Trump tax code, 35%, they'd only be paying 25%. And that's going to encourage a lot of people to get their money as pass-through businesses, or I should say a lot of high-end people. It might not matter for you or I, but if you had an income of $900,000, $1 million, $2 million, it would make a lot of sense for you to figure out how to get that as a pass-through business, and in that way pay much lower taxes. So you both get to evade taxes, and then from an aggregate economic standpoint, not only are we not getting the revenue, but we're wasting a lot of resources from the standpoint of the economy as a whole with people designing these pass-through businesses. That's not helping economic growth. It's going the wrong way.
And again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press and is the author most recently of Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Republican Tax Plan to Slow Growth. But again, we've seen this movie before, this bad movie before, in the case of what happened in Kansas under Senator Brownback. Now, Senator Brownback might well have been a genuine, you know, right-wing ideologue who actually believed in cutting taxes on the rich would suddenly raise all boats. A lot of the sort of propaganda that comes along with tax cuts from the rich, you know, when the Koch brothers talk about it, well, it just is such a coincidence that they end up doing better and end up paying less tax and getting even richer. And the same would be true of Donald Trump. So it's hard to see it as ideology and not see it as selfishness. But let's assume that Brownback really did believe the nonsense that he put in play in Kansas. The results are clear. They're just, the revenue's just dried up because of these pass-through exemptions. And won't that happen on a national scale if this gets...
It almost surely would. And what's really incredible was that you, when I've mentioned this to people about people setting up pass-through businesses, they think I'm like in fantasy land. I'm going, why wouldn't they do it? They could save tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands a year, by instead of having this come to the money come to them as a successful doctor or a bank executive or something, have it come through ABZ Incorporated. Why wouldn't they do that? Totally legal. It's 100% legal. Why wouldn't they do that? Save themselves tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. So people look at me like I'm just making things up. Well, it happened in Kansas because that's exactly what they did. They said they have an income tax in Kansas. I don't know the exact rate. Let's say 5%. I'm sure it's somewhat higher, somewhat lower, but a good place to start. And what they said was pass-through businesses don't have to pay that. So guess what? You had all these people in the Wall Street Journal had a piece on this that one of the coaches, I think a football coach at the University of Kansas, arranged to have most of his salary come to him in, as a pass-through corporation. He created the corporation, and he was getting, I don't know, $400,000 or $500,000 or $600,000 a year, came to him as a pass-through corporation, so he didn't have to pay income tax on that. So we've seen this movie, and the idea, people raise this with the Trump people, and they say, oh, we're going to put checks in place, which, again, just has you kind of scratching your head, because these guys have spent the last 20 years trying to eviscerate the IRS. It's not even clear, even if they had a well-operating IRS, what they could do, because, again, for the most part, this is legal. I mean, if you could somehow show that this is entirely a tax fraud, but unless they call you up and tell you it's a tax fraud, it's almost impossible to show. So why on earth wouldn't they be doing this on a massive basis? Every reason in the world to assume that the day this passes, I should say the day before it passes, when they know it's going to pass, they're all going to be running around there setting up their pass-through corporation so that they could get a big discount on their tax bill.
Well, the other thing that they're doing, and Mnuchin, the Secretary of Treasury, is very gung-ho on this idea of eliminating the federal tax deductions for state and local taxes. So that does seem to be really designed to hurt the successful blue states like California and the Northeast. And as we know, in California, we pay more to the federal government than we get back in taxes. And in effect, we subsidize these red states like Mississippi and Alabama. So when Mnuchin says that we're trying to close this major loophole to simplify taxes, it just seems highly coincidental that it's going to punish states that largely vote Democrat and have successful, robust economies like the California economy, which is, equivalent of the sixth or seventh largest economy in the world.
Yeah, this is when you look to get rid of loopholes, because their story, it's an old story. We're going to lower the rates and get rid of loopholes. You go, okay, fine. What loopholes are you going to get rid of? Well, the three largest are employer-provided health care insurance. Most of us who get insurance through our employer, we're not paying tax on that. So that's one loophole you could eliminate. There'd be all sorts of issues with that, but that's at least, you know, something, you know, it's on the block. It's big money. Second one is mortgage interest deduction. Very good argument, I would say, for at least limiting that. So the argument is we're making it easier for people to become homeowners. Well, that might be true for someone who earns $70,000 to $80,000 a year. Not clear that we have to do it for someone earning $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000 a year, particularly when the home they're buying might be a $700,000 or $900,000 home. I know that doesn't go that far in California, but in any case, most of that money goes to higher end taxpayers. So arguably, that would be a good thing to eliminate. But they don't want to do that because that would run afoul the real estate industry, construction industry, and higher end taxpayers. So what's left there is state and local income tax deduction, and that hits New York, it hits California. The wealthier states, blue states with high income taxes, because they provide higher levels of public services. Medi-Cal is, I'm sure, better than almost all the state Medicaid programs. You have a good, not as good as it used to be, but a good public education, good university system. So there's a lot of things. You have good public services, and that costs money. And they would just as soon see California not have good public services. So one way to try and discourage that is make you all pay higher taxes on the money that is being taxed away by the state and local governments there.
Well, I saw the picture today of Donald Trump holding up the executive order that he's just signed to essentially, you know, sabotage the Affordable Care Act, which they failed to do in the Senate. So he's passed this executive order that's going to basically make the whole thing collapse. But the smugness, the smile of satisfaction, it just hit me so hard. I just don't understand these people. I don't understand why they want to hurt their fellow Americans. I don't understand why they want to destroy things, why they don't want to build things, why they don't want to invest in America as opposed to hurting people and taking away what little they have. Is there any evidence that he's done anything to help anybody except the uber rich?
It's very hard to know what goes through the guy's head. I mean, it is kind of mind-boggling. My guess is he really has no idea what that executive order he signed will do. You might recall shortly after, I guess it's 2 or 3 months after he was in office, he had some occasion where he made a comment about health care reform. He said no one had any idea health care was so difficult. Basically, everyone in the whole country knew it was difficult, or at least anyone ever looked at it. So he was this apparently was news to him, and he didn't realize he was basically telling the country that he's an idiot. So what on earth goes through his head, I have no idea. The other people who are pushing these programs, I think it's incredibly cynical. Basically, they want money, and it really doesn't matter to them that millions of people might not be able to get the health care they need. I don't know what else you could say. I mean, I don't think they're all Donald Trump, I think, genuinely, not that I care about his soul, but I think he genuinely may have no idea what he's doing. But not all the people around him are totally ignorant, and they know people are being hurt by this.
Well, just in closing, though, Dean Baker, obviously he's been attacking Senator Corker. And Senator Corker is a real deficit hawk, and he's already indicated that he has qualms about it. Well, as we were discussing earlier with the experience of Kansas, with these pass-through companies, enabling them will absolutely destroy revenues. I mean, it's so obvious that the IRS revenues will go into the tank, and the deficit and the debt will just explode. I mean, isn't it obvious?
Yeah, it is obvious. And what's kind of incredible, here you had a party, the Republican Party, that spent 8 years when President Obama was in the White House yelling and screaming about how horrible the deficits and the debt were and the burden we're putting on our children and this and that. And they did shut down the government. I was going to say threaten. They actually did shut down the government several times. And now they control presidency, control both houses of Congress, and what are they going to do? They're going to hugely increase the deficit and debt. I'm not a deficit hawk. I'm not particularly worried about that, but if you'd been running around for 8 years saying this is the worst thing on earth, and then you run out and do it, you know, even more than President Obama did, a little hard to take that seriously. You'd think that they would have something to answer for their constituents.
Well, I'd say that caucus one vote against, and they've only got they can only afford to lose one other vote, right?
That's right. Well, they could lose. That's right. They could lose one other vote. If they lose two other votes, they're out. So they could lose Corker and one other person. That's right.
That's right. Well, I thank you for joining us, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and is author most recently of Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy are Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Republican Tax Plan to Slow Growth. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.